And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And if it's the fourth Tuesday of the month from 3 to 4, it's the Standard of Excellence show. And I'll tell you, Mitch Spean, who is the star of the show, we have a fantastic guest today.
I couldn't agree more.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. And Mitchell Spean, we're here every Friday. I mean, once a month on the Standard of Excellence show. Of course, Breakthrough Thinking is every day except Thursday on the air on KXXT 1010. But here's a gentleman that has been on our show before. He's had a debate on our show before, which was cool. But this is a guy of integrity, someone I've known now for a while, and just an amazing person, but great talent. So I always look at the person first. And this guy, who I'll announce in a second, has an amazing soul, someone that has family values, someone that really cares about the community, and he has super talents. Bill Montgomery, County Attorney for Maricopa, welcome to the show.
I don't think I'm going to say anything. That was a great introduction.
Well, I'll tell you, I was always impressed with you. I mean, I remember you're on many times on this show, and it was always a pleasure to understand your struggles growing up and how I believe you went to West Point, right?
I did.
And it just the determination you had to improve yourself so you could help others.
Well, that's right. We are an exceptional country, and the fact that I could rise out of my own background and experiences that I went through and the circumstances that I had to deal with to get an opportunity to go to a military academy like West Point and compete there and succeed, ever since then I felt that I have an obligation to give back, because only in the United States of America would I have had that kind of an opportunity.
There's no question about it, and it's just great to have you back now, because when you were on before, you were running for this the Maricopa County Attorney position, and you won, of course. And
that's right.
It's now like our two-year review, I guess.
Two-year review. Ordinarily, it's a four-year term, but because it was a special election, so I get to come back and do this in just 2 years.
Yeah, this is great. And then you're running again, I think, in November, right?
I am. Well, if I'm elected at today's primary, which – quite honestly, since I'm unopposed, I should be.
Oh, I would say so.
So, you know, if I'm not on the ballot in
November,
would
be a bad thing.
Yeah, other stuff happened.
And anyone who wants to vote for him should go out and get the vote out today.
Oh, everyone get out there and vote. I mean, that's the thing. We want people to vote.
Absolutely. You know, we've, over the years, over 1 million Americans have given their life in defense of this country and the values that are embodied in our founding documents and in our Constitution. And so that right to vote is not just a sacred right, it's a sacred obligation.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. So get out, you know, whoever you vote for, but that's what makes America great. You have,
just make sure you vote for me in the Republican
primary. Yeah, exactly.
Attorney,
so. Now, are you going to be, before we get into some of your great accomplishments, what you've done in less than 2 years, actually, are you running again? Well, in November you're going to run against someone, right?
Correct. There is. I do have an opponent in the general election. Conveniently enough, it was the gentleman who ran against me last time.
Mike Okelski.
That's right. I wasn't going to name his name, though.
Oh, sorry.
I figured he's got to earn that kind of recognition.
That's right. Another debate? Wouldn't that be fun?
I'd be more than happy to. I guess if you want to run on a platform of greater dissension in county government and greater crime, you could run against me.
Oh, there we go. So, see, we already got the debate curiosity going, and that should be a lot of fun. Yeah,
go.
I remember.
You've
that
got that teaser out there.
Yeah.
But it was a very friendly debate. It was very cool.
Oh, it was. Yeah. And here's, having been to war, I know what an enemy looks like. And no fellow American, regardless of what their party affiliation may be, is my enemy. Mm. We may have differing political philosophies and views on the role government should play in our lives, but the best way for Americans to be able to make a decision about who they want to represent themselves is to understand what those competing philosophies are and what that might look like, which might be a nice segue then into some of the things that we wound up doing after what I said I was going to do 2 years ago.
Absolutely. It's a great segue. And Bill, let's talk about some of these things. The first thing is the Citizen Self-Defense Review Committee. You talked about that before you got elected. And how's that going? Why don't you describe that?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I had talked about in seeking this office was that I wanted to make sure that it was criminals in our community who walked around in fear, and that citizens did not, that we were protecting them and providing for as much public safety as possible. And in those instances in which a citizen was faced with having to use force up to and including deadly physical force in exercising their right to self-defense, I did not want them to fear subsequent prosecution and thereby jeopardize themselves or their families. And so after taking office, I looked at how we review incidents involving police officers. You know, police officers, as the most visible sign of civil authority in our society, are given great authority and are given the right, if you will, or the authorization to use force up to and including deadly physical force to stop crime or to defend themselves. And when that happens, we review those cases in the county attorney's office to determine whether or not charges should be filed. But we review that up front so that a police officer doesn't have to go through the indictment process and then the initial criminal justice process, only for us to then later review the circumstances and decide, you know what, this was a justifiable use of force. We're not going to charge the case. We're not going to continue to prosecute. Well, I thought if we're willing to do that in a circumstance where we're recognizing someone's lawful authority that have been delegated to them by society, then we ought to do the same thing for citizens who have an inherent right to use self-defense where necessary. So when we get cases where there is a legitimate allegation of self-defense, it goes in front of the Citizen Self-Defense Review Committee. This committee is made up of the same people who also sit on the Officer Involved Committee, and they determine whether or not there is objective evidence to support the assertion of self-defense and if it meets the standards that are provided for within our laws. And if it does, we never charge the citizen in the first place. They don't have to go retain a criminal defense attorney. They don't have to go through literally the financial expense, but also the emotional expense of being prosecuted. In the roughly 20 months since it has been in effect, last year and this year, we're averaging roughly one-third of the cases that are submitted for review. We agree that self-defense was legitimately asserted, and so we don't charge. And the other two-thirds of the cases, a couple of them we furthered for additional information from law enforcement, and then in the balance of those, we've decided to go ahead and charge the case, which doesn't prevent someone from raising self-defense in their trial. It just means that we're willing to take on the challenge of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not a self-defense case.
What a great committee, then. You know how many people you have saved emotional distress, financial distress by reviewing it up front. I think this is a great idea.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that most of these cases that we review, someone still died. If someone used self-defense in a situation where they used deadly physical force, we've got two families, one worried about whether or not they're going to lose their loved one to incarceration, and another family that lost a loved one. So these reviews are very significant, and we deal with them accordingly.
Now, could the family of the victim then do a civil lawsuit?
They could. Just because we take a look at it and from a criminal standpoint determine that there's no reasonable likelihood of conviction, or we feel that from a criminal standpoint there's no liability to be assigned, that doesn't mean that that the surviving family members of the person who may have lost their life can't bring a civil suit. That's still something for the civil justice system to take a look
at. And that's a different standard, evidently.
Oh, it is very much a different standard. We have to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt, and on the civil side, it's just a mere preponderance of the evidence, so you know, a mere scintilla of evidence above a 50-50 split to convince a jury.
And there was a classic case that had that, and that's L.J. Simpson case, where the criminal thing, he won, but I believe he lost the civil case.
Oh, he did. He did, and he faced a very severe civil sanction, and over the course of time, there were instances in which property was taken and auctioned off to try to satisfy that judgment.
And he ends up in jail anyway.
Exactly where he should have been.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's like he gets off the biggest case ever, maybe in history, and then he pulls a gun on someone in Vegas to get his stuff back, and he ends up in jail. I never could figure that one out.
You know, that's called
cosmic justice, right?
Cosmic justice, karma, or you know, what goes around comes around, yeah. Sometimes at twice the velocity.
And it did. Wow, now, that was bizarre. Go ahead, Mitch.
The makeup of the board, does that have civilians and individuals from the police department? How's that, the makeup of the people that are actually making the decisions on that board?
Sure. Well, and a little bit about the mechanics of it, too. The board will convene. It's made up primarily of prosecutors with over 20 years' experience in prosecution. And the majority of them also sit on other committees to include our capital case review committee. So many of them have either prosecuted homicides themselves or supervised the prosecution of a homicide case. And then when we sit down and review it, police officers who are associated with the investigation will come in order to present the information that they have Over the course of their investigation, we may ask additional questions. They may be asked to go do additional testing or get additional forensic analysis concluded. And then the recommendation from that is forwarded to me for my review and ultimate decision. And I have it organized that way because ultimately I want one person for the community to be able to hold accountable. If they don't like how that's working, if they think those decisions are being made inappropriately, too little, too often, then they need to be able to affect change in that regard. And the only way to do that is for me to say that I'm the one responsible for it. Even though I may be relying on input from seasoned prosecutors, I'm the one who has to make that final decision.
Wow, how many cases do you have a year or a month?
Felonies?
Yeah, I mean, from this review board.
Last year, this board reviewed roughly, I want to say, 24 cases. Mm. So far this year, we've reviewed 18.
Really? 18 so far. So you're on pace to...
About the same.
It'll wind up being about the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are some cases where somebody will allege self-defense, but it's very clear that it's not a legitimate allegation, so it doesn't come to us for review. But I think what those numbers reflect is that while there are instances in which we have the scenario come about, it's not so often that I see a problem for Arizona when it comes to people asserting self-defense and the use of deadly physical force, but that there are enough cases that come through that warrant the kind of review that I'm saying we do.
Well, given 24, you know, that compared to the regular caseload before you added that part to this, what was the caseload before the additional 24, let's say?
Oh, how many other cases might we have had in that regard?
Right.
Great question. I don't know. This is a difficult area if you're not focusing on it to capture the data to try to figure out how many times are you charging manslaughter or second-degree or first-degree murder cases where there's an allegation of self-defense. You know, sometimes you don't know someone wants to raise that defense until before trial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is an instance where, at least at the outset of an investigation, we know that there has been an assertion to law enforcement that the suspect asserts that that they used force as in response to a self-defense situation.
I know it's difficult when you're talking about working with the various boards, even to, you know, as far, even if it's the police-related actions that you're looking at, it's really important for the officers themselves to feel comfortable with the process.
Right. And when you talk about the officer-involved review committee, it is very important because I don't want police officers second-guessing whether or not their decision to use force is going to result in criminal charges. Mm-hmm. When a police officer in that circumstance starts thinking outside of the context of what they're immediately engaged in, now officer safety is endangered. And if we're going to have a circumstance in which force is going to be used, I want police officers to rely on their training and their experience and not worry about being second-guessed. We're going to review it. And if someone is using lethal force in an unlawful manner, we'll charge them. And this office has done it. And we're prosecuting police officers now for some of those cases. But at the same time, the vast majority of times that police are put in that situation, they're making hard decisions, but they're making the right decisions.
It's got to be so difficult to be a police officer, I'm thinking. You have to, I mean,
you've got to make decisions in a split second.
Yeah. I mean, right. that I can't even imagine.
Well, and we're very fortunate here in Maricopa County, too, because my law enforcement liaison who goes out and represents my office in walkthroughs on officer-involved shootings is a competitive shooter, an NRA-certified firearms instructor, has a great working relationship with law enforcement. So when he's taking a look at the scenario and trying to determine whether or not the tactics used were appropriate, whether or not as the situation is being described how it developed actually could have happened, given the forensics and the path of a bullet and what a suspect may have been doing, is, I think, very beneficial to law enforcement. They know that that they've got someone who understands what they're being asked to do. And then when it comes to presenting that to me for a decision, you know, my own military background and being asked to make decisions that affected the life and well-being of other human beings allows me to appreciate the circumstance that they were in as well. You know, it's not that there is a default to always accept what the police officer says, but there is an appreciation and an understanding for the nature of the circumstances that they're in when they have to make these decisions.
Well, that and the fact that when you're doing this, you're not saying guilty or not guilty. You're just saying proceed with the next process.
Oh, true. Yeah. At the end of the day, I'm not the one who makes a decision about whether or not someone's been guilty of a crime. That's the jury's role.
Now, is the basis of this particular committee, the review committee, is from the law, Stand Your Ground laws, and I think it's called the Castle Doctrine?
Right, and that's the way we've always approached it here in Arizona. We initially referred to the set of laws as the Castle Doctrine, and this happened back in 2006, and I supported the change back then for two reasons. One, I believe that the burden of proof should always be on the state, even if it's to rebut someone's claim that they were using self-defense. But secondly, you know, it's important that for citizens, if you're in your home, if you're with your family and somebody threatens you, then you do have the right to defend yourself. And under Arizona law, there's not a duty to retreat before you use force. And that makes sense to me. I shouldn't have to try to figure out a way to get away from the person threatening me at the same time as I also have to figure out in my mind, but what if I can't get away? Mm-hmm. I would rather have someone who's considering committing a crime against another individual stopping and second-guessing themselves about whether or not it makes sense to try and commit this crime or if they're going to lose their life in that process. That's where I want all the hesitation to be.
Gotcha. Wow. Very interesting. And but it sounds like a great committee to have, this review committee. No question about it. And I congratulate you on getting this going.
Well, thank you.
Very good. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with our very special guest, Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery, in the studio, along with Mitch Spean. We'll be right back.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
And now, one of my favorite attorneys, Joe Collins, you have a great firm. A family atmosphere with great sophistication.
That's my dad's kind of theory. When we started, he always kind of touts himself as the old country lawyer. We pride ourselves at having somebody answer the phone. You don't have a computer system answering it. We try to give personal service.
Tell us a little bit about the firm in terms of where you focus your attention.
We probably do 60-70% family law, and we really enjoy it. Family law encompasses such a wide variety of topics. But, you know, for the most part, you feel rewarded that you're helping somebody out. Family law is probably the most rewarding.
Why don't we give your website out?
It's real simple, collinslaw.net. The email's just the same, joecollins@collinslaw.net.
602-788-7227. Call Joe Collins and Collins. Great family law attorneys and more.
Are you standing at a crossroad in life wondering what's next? Is it time to reinvent your relationship, your career, your life? Whether you're ready for a reinvention revolution or a reinvention evolution, the support of a couple of great coaches can get you there. When you decide it's time to take your life from just functional to optimal, call Joe and Lori Battaglia of Living the Dream Coaches, 888-505-5762. That's 888-505-5762 or go online to www.livingthedreamcoaches.com. That's www.livingthedreamcoaches.com.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is a standard of excellence show every fourth Tuesday from 3 to 4. And of course, we have our very special guest, Bill Montgomery, Maricopa County Attorney, in studio. A friend that we've had for a couple years now, and have followed your career, doing a great job as the county attorney. We just talked about the Citizen Self-Defense Review Committee. That was very interesting. And if you want to hear that again, you can always hear the archive shows at breakradioshow.com. Now, another thing that you've gotten into, domestic violence, strangulation.
Well, I've gotten into prosecuting.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I didn't say that quite right, did I? That would be, let's beep that out. Let's reverse the tape on that. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Prosecuting domestic violence, strangulations. Yeah, that would, Mitch, take over. Okay. Anyway, Bill, thank you.
Tell
for
us
that.
About it.
Yeah, yeah, tell us about that. That sounded very interesting and very helpful, what you've done there.
Sure. Well, you know, I've got some really great prosecutors in the office who handle domestic violence cases, and they also are advocates in their own right in the community. And they identified an area of strangulation cases where we were turning down far more cases than we were able to file after law enforcement was submitting charges for domestic violence strangulation. And they sat down to take a look at it, and then they partnered with Scottsdale Healthcare to get some more advanced cameras to be able to identify evidence of strangulation in the first instance. And let me set the stage for you. When previous to this, a woman was strangled, and the overwhelming circumstances involve a man strangling a woman. So this isn't a sexist orientation. This is just what the facts are. So a woman is strangled by a man. If he's done it more than once and he's gotten good at it, he knows how to do it without leaving any external or visible to the eye marks. So law enforcement shows up. She finally gets the courage to call police, and they come, and she tells him, you know, he strangled me. And the police officer is looking at her neck area, looking at her face area, and doesn't see anything. But she says it happened. Maybe there's some broken glass in the house, what have you, and so they're going to arrest the male. They're going to arrest the man. Well, when that gets submitted to our office, we literally have a she said, he said scenario where there's no objective evidence or corroborating evidence for the victim's story, and we turn the case down. Well, we turn the case down, the suspect is then let go, and guess what happens? He goes back to the home and says, see, I told you nobody can do anything. Well, the partnership between my office and Scottsdale Healthcare resulted in them going out and purchasing cameras anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000, extremely high-resolution cameras. And with this technology, they were able to take photographs of the skin, of the eyes, behind the lips, and the roof of the mouth, and see broken blood vessels down at the capillary level that show objective evidence that someone had been strangled. And as a consequence of that, we decided to put together a pilot project. And we started off with Glendale and Chandler. And we took a look at the number of cases they had submitted and the ones in which we'd been successful to charge a case. And we'd only been charging about 14% of the cases. Well, we started this pilot project, and after 3 months, we took a look at it, and we were able to file charges in 60% of the cases. So that was a nearly fivefold increase. And why is that important? Additional statistics reveal that if a woman has been a victim of strangulation, she is 7 times more likely to become a victim of homicide.
I read that, and again, that is remarkable how many lives you may be saving because of this one particular pilot program.
Right, and this reflects an approach to fighting crime that I also talked about wanting to do when I saw at the office, which is to identify areas where we are not effectively holding offenders accountable, and then figure out, are there things that we need to do better from a process standpoint, how we're working with law enforcement to obtain evidence, the use of technology, and all of those factors came together here to identify the need to be able to prosecute strangulation cases better. And the expectation now is, because we're able to charge and hold offenders accountable after a strangulation incident, we're not going to have additional domestic violence incidents, so we can break that cycle. And then the expectation, too, because of the higher incidence of victims of strangulation becoming a victim of a homicide, we should also be able to drive down the total number of domestic violence homicides.
Which is great. Now, is this, when they get prosecuted, is this like attempted murder, or what's the charge usually?
If we got the evidence, sure, we charge attempted murder. But most often, the strangulation, which is not choking. You know, you choke on a chicken bone. Strangulation involves one human being putting their hands on another, for the most part. and closing off their airway or closing off the carotid artery or the jugular vein, in which case you now are affecting blood flow and oxygen supply to the brain, and you can cause a lot of damage. That's a Class 4 felony. So if it's a first-time offense, because it's not classified as a dangerous offense, given that no other instruments might be used, they could be eligible for probation, but they're going to go on a felony probation caseload. And if they get revoked, they can serve 2.5 years in prison for that first offense on average. And so that right there, putting an offender in a situation where they're at risk of incarceration, can also be a great tool in stopping that cycle of violence.
Which is excellent. Now, what came to mind now is that you have these sophisticated and expensive cameras to see certain things that you couldn't see before. Could someone set up a situation, let's say you said usually a lot of times it's men with spouses or girlfriends or whoever.
Right.
Could the girlfriend or the spouse self-strangulate and create the same scenario? Or is that just not going to happen? Just sort of popped up in my mind.
You know, it would auto asphyxiation could happen, but
not to the degree of someone else doing it, probably.
Yeah, I won't say it couldn't happen. I'll just say it would be highly suspicious because of the likely lack of additional corroborating evidence other than a simple simple evidence that something was done. Now, without giving away any secrets here, if someone tried to do that to themselves, odds are probably good that that whatever forensic evidence they leave behind is going to reflect that it was self-induced or self-imposed.
That's good, because I started curious about that. And but again, this is really good stuff to protect so many people, and that's really what you're doing as a county attorney. You're protecting so many people.
It is a core component of the job to contribute to public safety through effective prosecutions and in holding offenders accountable. It's all wrapped up in with what I think are some of my core responsibilities.
Now, with all this new sophisticated equipment, have you found other areas that you could take this into and be able to take advantage of this additional technology?
You know, this is the second day in a row and I've talked about it, and the second day in a row I've gotten that question. It could happen because our partnership with Scottsdale Healthcare is with forensic nurse examiners. And in their treatment of patients, they might come across other instances in which you could have similar injuries. And they might use the camera to help document that, too, in the course of providing treatment to individuals. And I want to underscore that, too. We're talking about nurses, so their first and foremost concern is providing medical treatment and care to their patients. The fact that out of that care and treatment, we might get evidence for a prosecution, it may be a consequence of it, but it's not the first focus for the nurses. But it could happen in other instances. Could it happen in a case of child abuse and neglect? It sure could. You know, the instances in which women are brought for an examination, it could be either to an emergency room or to a family advocacy center, and we have several throughout the valley, and the forensic nurse examiners will come to those locations. Mm. Well, in some of these locations, we also deal with victims of child abuse or neglect. So is there a possibility that we might be able to use that technology in those areas too? Sure.
So that's good. Technology, as it progresses forward, really helps, doesn't it?
It sure can, as long as your operating system doesn't shut down.
Yeah, I guess we got to get a Mac, but I don't know. That brings us into something else that you we're forming an Arizona Child Safety Task Force, and I think Governor Brewer asked you to do that?
Correct. About 8 months into my first, so far has been my first term in office, I noted that we were averaging one child fatality a month, and it was due to child abuse or neglect. In about a quarter of those cases, there had been prior CPS involvement. And in looking at it, it was obvious that we as a child protective system were failing. We weren't making the right call. And so the day that I announced that we were going to pursue charges in the death of a little girl who had been locked in a storage box and that we were going to seek the death penalty and stomping death of a four-year-old, I issued a call that we wanted to have more people reporting instances of child abuse if they saw it, to trust their gut, to not worry about being prosecuted or sued because they'd have immunity under Arizona law. And out of that, we started to have more of a public discussion about what needed to be done. And I think Governor Brewer saw that as an opportunity to make significant reform, And so she put together a child safety task force. She asked me to chair it. And then she also made the director of DES, Clarence Carter, a co-chairman or vice chairman of that task force, which to me demonstrated several key points. Number one, the governor was exercising leadership, which we hadn't had before. Secondly, we had the head of DES participating, which has responsibility for CPS, willing to be an advocate for reform, something we hadn't had before. And then by design or mistake, the governor had put a former tank platoon leader in charge of it, so I knew we were going to get something done.
I like it.
And as a consequence of that, we made, I think, over 50 different specific reforms in the areas of managerial reform, statutory reform, legislative reforms, protocol reforms, in order to really make serious changes. And the cornerstone of that was to recommend the creation of an Office of Child Welfare Investigations independent of CPS, still within DES itself, because it sort of provides a bridge before between law enforcement and the delivery of social services. And we transitioned the responsibility for investigations from CPS to this Office of Child Welfare Investigations. And the people who are going to populate that office are going to be trained on how law enforcement conducts investigations so that they can be partners and assist in that effort. And they're not going to have a responsibility for carrying a caseload for the delivery of social services, and neither will social workers any longer be expected to come up with a plan to provide services and then drop everything and go investigate potential crimes against children.
So what are the results, or what do you anticipate the results to be as reforming all this?
Sure. Well, this office needs to be up and running initially by the end of this year with the first cohort numbering about 28. They've been funded by the legislature. Hmm. They see this as a public safety issue, and I congratulate them greatly for seeing it that way and for providing the necessary funding. The expectation is this. First, by relieving CPS caseworkers of the duty to investigate, we're going to help them focus on their tasks at hand, which will change the environment in which they're working. And my expectation, too, is that we'll then be able to assess exactly what a proper caseload is when they're focusing on what it is that they want to do and that they're trained to do best. Another expected outcome is that with trained investigators and this cadre being the same ones going out, the same ones working with law enforcement, investigation to investigation, we'll get better calls up front on when children are at risk, better calls assessing crisis situations, and better calls about when cases can be referred for the delivery of social services. And then another expectation is that because law enforcement are going to be working with trained professionals in that area to assist them, we'll have better response. We'll have a greater appreciation that when they're called out, that it's for a very serious matter, and we'll have closer coordination and a better implementation of our joint investigative protocol. The upshot of all of that is then that when we have to prosecute a case for criminal abuse or neglect, we're going to be more successful. And where we've identified a family that just needs social services, the intervention will be as minimal as possible, and that family will be put on a path to success.
So a good allocation of resources for one reason, to, safety for children.
Exactly. If we're going to say our child protection system is meant to protect children, then that should be the priority, and we do what we need to do.
You know, it's amazing as we're talking, Bill, that you're involved in so many things. I don't think people realize what your role it really encompasses. Let's talk a little bit about that, because it amazes me. I mean, you're trained as an attorney, of course, but it's much more than that, isn't it?
Well, as the county attorney, I'm actually the department head for the nation's third largest prosecution agency with over 300 prosecutors. When you add in the attorneys who work in the Civil Services Division, that's another 40 to 50 attorneys. All told, I have over 900 people who work within the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and I just identified prosecutors in the Civil Services Division. Not only do I have responsibility for all the felony prosecutions in the county and all the juvenile adjudications, but I also have civil litigation responsibilities to represent the county mm-hmm. in lawsuits and to provide advice and civil services to other agencies and officials.
How do you do it all? That's what I want to know. That's just incredible, really.
Well, and this is where my prior leadership background and training has really helped in being comfortable and confident in leading such a large organization. I have a great senior management team of prosecutors, most of whom have over 20 years of experience. And so I delegate a lot of strategic decisions to them and get their input on making decisions that affect the course of criminal trials. And I have a person heading up my civil services division who's a former managing partner for a local law firm, and so is very familiar with how to handle that kind of managerial responsibility. And then another thing that I did upon taking office was I reoriented the focus for my first-line supervisors, where I made them accountable for everybody assigned to their bureau. Previously, they had only been responsible for their attorneys because they're attorneys themselves, and I shifted that. I wanted there to be greater responsibility and decision-making exercised at the lowest level possible, because that's where a lot of the work gets done in the first place. And so if you can make a decision to affect the course of a case and get it addressed as quickly as possible, you're able to handle a higher volume, you're able to do more things than waiting for things to bubble up for an executive-level decision. Sure, that has to happen on occasion, but those should be the one-offs. Those should be the ones where you're dealing with unique circumstances that that office policy or prior practices may not really adequately take into account. And so at the end of the day, Dave, I'd have to say that I'm able to run that office because I have great people who work there who care about serving the community, and it's their goal to do a good job. And so it's just my responsibility to create an environment in which they have the resources to do it and the freedom to do it, and acknowledge when they do it right, and help provide correction where they do it wrong.
And that's what I wrote down as you were talking. What it reminded me of is a culture shift. You came in, and really, it may not have been a major shift, I'm not sure, but you dictated the culture, and it starts from the top.
It starts from the top, but if you want to really exercise positive change management, you got to get buy-in from the people who actually have the responsibility to carry it out. And it's another thing that we did very deliberately. Before I assigned all these new responsibilities, we brought in some outside experts to help do the training that helped to reinforce what I was saying was my philosophy of how I wanted the office to run, what I expected of management and supervisors. And we went through and identified what those duties and responsibilities would be for each level of management, what the expectations would be for people in carrying out the professional duties and responsibilities of the office. And, you know, from the top, I've got to lead by example and also set the tone. So one of the first things that I did, too, was we established a model for the office, which was service with integrity, ensuring justice for all. And that captures everything, whether it's on the civil service side or on the criminal prosecution side. And it doesn't matter whether it's an external customer or an internal customer. That kind of philosophy and approach is, you know, what I believe is expected of law enforcement officials in the community, and it's what we're going to deliver.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I'm a CPA as well as a business consultant, and Mitch is a CPA. And as you're talking about this, you could really teach and give great lessons to a lot of businesses in their management style, because this could be a model for others. I like what you said. You brought in trainers to reinforce your philosophy.
Right, and that's something that I think most CEOs don't think about. You don't have to be the one to actually do all the training or to do all the communication. Sometimes it can be equally effective to bring an outside voice in that can reinforce the message you're delivering, and they may have just a little bit of a different way of delivering it, whatever it takes to get it to sink in. At the end of the day, I'll take advantage of that point to broaden this just beyond my office. Whether your business is delivering a widget or delivering a service, one of the first and key aspects of ownership is to identify what is it that I'm doing and who do I need to do it well for me to be successful. And then it's always people first. So you've got to hire great people who are going to complement the mission of your organization, who buy into your philosophy of how you get things done. And then it's your job as the leader to make sure you give them the resources to do it in the environment in which they have the opportunity to excel and the freedom to make mistakes.
You know, it makes so much sense, and I think so many businesses could benefit from what you just said and really learn and expand upon it, because obviously you have great leadership qualities, and to be able to do a culture shift like that is, you know, a lot of – well, let me ask you, did you get any resistance at all, or and how did you handle that?
Sure, and there's still some resistance.
Yeah.
You know, even about a year and a half later, but – you know, there's two points to that. One is to not ignore the fact that there's going to be resistance. And the second thing is, though, not to take it for granted, to continue to work on trying to get everybody's buy-in. You'll always have some who won't, but that then becomes their decision. They just want to be obstinate. But you know, in doing that, some of the important things is to continue to be consistent about what that message is and to continue to demonstrate and communicate at every opportunity. One of the most important things that I believe I do for the office in our particular situation is that when I go out in the community, I continue to emphasize all of those positive aspects of what we do so that internally when I keep telling people what the expectations are, they hear me saying the same thing when I'm out in the community. Anybody from my office who's listening to this radio show right now will say, I've heard him say that at least a dozen times, and that's important. And that also then reflects that it's got to come from within as a leader. You've got to believe it yourself to start with. You've got to recognize who you are and where you need to seek self-improvement. You've got to be consistent in your decisions, make sound and timely decisions. And those are sort of the hallmarks of what it takes to be a good leader. You can learn these things, but then you've got to be consistent in the implementation. Now, over the course of time, the way you get people to buy in who may be initially resistant to change is you just keep doing it. And you show them that, I'm sorry, but this is not going to change. This is a course that we're on, and we're going to continue to move forward.
And what you're really saying is something I like is you raise the standards, and there's two things that can happen, but not really. People will have to come up to your standard. You are not going down to their standard.
Oh, exactly.
And that's like non-negotiable, right?
Absolutely. No, there is a standard where we expect professionalism within the office. Another way that I refer to it is there are people who will self-select. Where that's not a standard they want to meet, and they're going to go do something different. And that's okay, because if they can find something else to do that allows them to become a happy and healthy human being, great for them. But we're going to continue to move forward because of the expectations that the community has for what we do.
And they have to own their decision.
Well, they do. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned setting standards. I remember as a plebe at West Point, gosh, the first day of second semester coming back, and an upperclassman saying, remember, standards never drop.
So that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, standards never drop. So if you think you know it all after one semester, guess what? We just raise the standards.
That is very cool, and that's what makes probably West Point such a great school.
That and one of these days we'll be at Navy.
Yeah.
Can we talk about basketball instead?
No, we're going to talk about – let's talk about the Fiesta Bowl probe. See, and that a great segue. We, of course, you know, we have some sports programming, too, on Wednesday and Friday.
Right.
And that was well, that hit the papers everywhere. In fact, they were thinking of taking away some of the bowl stuff in Glendale. But so tell us a little bit about that. You were involved in that, an 8-month criminal, I guess, investigation you were looking at. And maybe go over that a little bit.
Sure. And I'd like to do it, too, to illustrate how I approach investigations like this and what I think needs to be done in reviewing matters, given what really is the awesome authority a prosecutor has in the criminal justice system, which then means there is an awesome responsibility. The responsibility for investigating a number of legislators in the Fiesta Bowl was handed off from the Attorney General's office to the County Attorney's office. Mm. And so we took a look at roughly 30 legislators who had been identified as receiving travel or lodging or food or tickets from the Fiesta Bowl. And roughly half of those legislators had properly reported everything. But we took a look at it anyways because we wanted to understand, all right, why did they report the way that they did to accurately reflect all the information, and what did they know, and how did they gain that knowledge in order to compare and contrast to other legislators where it appeared that they had not properly reported. And over the course of doing that, it became very clear that the standards we needed to abide by in order to bring criminal charges couldn't be met. And that was due in part to multiple provisions trying to communicate the same requirements for filing campaign finance paperwork in different titles within different statutes. And so legislators could say, well, I was abiding by this particular provision in the statute in Title 41, but at the same time, they were actually in violation of a statutory section in Title 19. And they would say, well, but I never checked that because I checked with an attorney and they just told me I needed to make sure I was in compliance with this other provision. So we had conflicting statutes. We didn't have corroborating evidence to support circumstantial evidence that suggested that people knew when they filed campaign finance reports that they were wrong. And that was the mens rea. That was the mental state standard for us to be able to bring charges, that the act had to be intentional or knowing. And when we went to look into records, particularly from the Fiesta Bowl, they were shoddy at best. There was missing information. There was one legislator that the Fiesta Bowl claimed had never reimbursed them for the price of a ticket, and the legislator turned around and actually provided us with a copy of a canceled check.
Wow.
So with information like that, I also can't just go off of the statements of people who were working at the Fiesta Bowl at that time, because I had firsthand knowledge now the claims that they had made that I otherwise would have relied upon in filing a charge were flat out wrong. They also had missing paperwork. They would claim that they provided travel and lodging to a particular legislator and their spouse, and there was never any record of the spouse having gone on the trip, or they weren't able to provide records that actually showed how much that travel and lodging cost. And there were dollar thresholds that had to be exceeded in order to trigger certain reporting requirements. Well, without all that objective evidence, I'm sorry. I am not going to file a criminal charge against someone hoping I'm going to get a jury to convict. Our charging standard is a reasonable likelihood of conviction, and it's going to be based on evidence. It's not going to be based on how I feel about the nature of the conduct. It's going to be based on whether or not we can objectively bring the case. And at the end of the day, given all of that information and lack thereof, we could not make criminal cases against those legislators where it appeared that they had not properly disclosed the information.
Wow, there's probably a lot of legislature. I mean, anytime you're under investigation, I guess that's not the most pleasant time in your life.
No, and we tried to conclude it as quickly as possible, but I also was not going to sacrifice expediency for thoroughness. I wanted to make sure that we had all the information available, and we reviewed it very carefully as prosecutors. And then I held a roughly 1.5-2 hour press conference to walk through every single piece of evidence and explain how it fit or did not fit into the overall case, so that members of the media would be able to accurately relay that information to their respective audiences. I wanted people to understand what we learned from the course of the investigation, because I also came up with specific recommendations for what we needed to do with the statutes. I stand by those recommendations today. I think we need to combine the statutory provisions for lobbyists and legislators in the same section so that there's a consistent set of definitions that applies to both equally. That would prevent people from claiming that they had conflicting compliance requirements. I also offered recommendations about either banning all gifts outright or setting such a de minimis threshold that everything gets reported. Now, I will tell you, after having been in office myself now almost 2 years, there are some instances in which somebody wants to buy you a lunch just because they want to go out and talk over lunch. You know, if you want to then say, okay, rather than say nobody can buy you a lunch, because I'm sorry, buying me a $25 lunch is not going to influence my decision making.
Yeah.
It just isn't, unless it's a really good steak. It's just not going to influence me. But, you know, if you want to say everything over $25, regardless of who gives it to you, you've got to report it. I think that's fine. I think the more disclosure and the ease of access for the public is the way in which constituents are able to hold their elected officials accountable. You know, if I want to take a $500 gift from somebody and then I turn around and vote on something that might benefit them, I'd better be prepared to answer questions from my constituents on what kind of a connection there was, if any.
So this is great, because you really set the example to start cleaning up what a lot of America is now seeing in states and in Washington and so on, you know, with lobbyists and so on and other politicians. So you probably got to feel good about that you're there, you cleaned up this Fiesta Bowl situation, set new standards, and it set an example, and maybe that will translate outward and really send the message to other cities, other counties, and maybe even the Washington.
We'll see about the latter.
That's a tough one, right?
But even then, you know, that was one of the first major investigations that we conducted since I took office. If that's the only time we do that, I don't think it will have the same kind of effect. We've got to be consistent that whenever we have high-profile investigations like that, we demonstrate a commitment to the integrity of the investigation. We don't use it as a media event. We don't use it to try to create controversy. We conduct a very thorough investigation based solely on the evidence at hand, and we're fair and even-handed in doing that. And then at the end of the day, there's a full accounting to the public.
And that's what's important, and that's really what I was getting at, that the integrity is so key. And I think you can't replace integrity with anything.
Well, no, and integrity, hard to earn, easy to lose, and difficult, if not impossible, to get back.
Wow, nicely said. I remember when you were on before, you had a lot of these sayings. I loved them. No, I really did.
And how do you keep politics out of the job? Because
that's got to be. Yeah, that's a good question.
It's just,
it's integrity, I would say.
Well, one of the first things that I told folks in the office was that there's only one person in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office responsible for politics, and that's me. They just need to do their job.
I like it. Bill Montgomery, it's such a pleasure to have you on again. I'm really excited that you came on and explained some of these great things you've done. Good luck in November, and we'll get you on in a debate with Michael again.
Sure thing.
I didn't say his last name this time.
Thanks, Mitch.
All right, Mitchell, thank you so much. Everyone, have a great night. Go D-backs, and see you tomorrow on the Sports Show.